This is Jeff.
This is Brandon.
We're the Film Blurs. This episode is brought to you by
Puma. Presents the new AC Milan third kit for the 2021-22 season. The bold new progressive jersey takes traditional design and rewrites the rules to push the boundaries and defy convention. The new AC Milan third kit creates a fearless new expression of the club's identity and challenges tradition by reimagining conventional football kits in a brand new approach that merges football and streetwear culture. Puma, we are forever faster. Puma.com.
This is Kevin.
And this is Ron.
From the Your Valuable Home Podcast.
And you are listening to
The Film Blurs
on the new Pod City Podcast Network.
Get your films on with the Blurs.
Once an idea has taken hold of the brain, it's almost impossible to eradicate.
Unpacking movies has never been more spot on, woke, fire, and just plain lit.
They are lit all the time.
So if you're unsure whether or not to plop down some cash for a film, check out the Blurs.
When a man with a .45 meets a man with a rifle, the man with a pistol is a dead man.
Rondo's got what plants crave.
It's got electrolytes.
You really only need to hang, mean bastard. But mean bastards, you need to hang.
Don't say you weren't warned. Ridiculous. Here's Brandon and Jeff.
All right, welcome to the Dune episode of the Film Blurs. This is episode 24. My name's Brandon Norwood, a.k.a. Hero Protagonist, a.k.a. The True Father of Joe's Kids, a.k.a. The Lethal Protector, a.k.a. Papi Chulo, sticking Molly in your women's butt and getting your grandma pregnant, a.k.a. Ruff McGruff, the king of ripping runs, and a.k.a. B. Wood the Magnificent. Joined by...
This is Jeff Stewart, a.k.a. Uncle Jeffrey, a.k.a. He Who Remains, a.k.a. Revengeman Buttons, a.k.a. To Be Determined, a.k.a. I'm out here in these streets.
All right. Well, let's start off by real quickly jumping into episode 2 of Aquaman, King of Atlantis. What did you think?
It got weirder.
Yes.
Did it get weirder?
Yes.
Yeah.
It was funnier.
Like, I fuck with this episode less than I fucked with the first one. It got a little too weird. Like, I get what they're doing. I get it. 100%. But it's just not for me. You know what I'm saying?
That's fair. I wish them, like I said last time, I wish the movies were like this. Honestly, it got fucking surreal at points. And you know what? I'm excited for this last episode. That's all I can say.
Yeah, I'm going to stick through it. But this one was hard for me. It was like, and you know what? I fucking hate Ocean Master's voice. Like, but I hate it. I don't fuck with this type of animation, and it's just like too weird for me and not weird enough.
All right, well, I mean,
it's not subversive. I want it subversive.
Nah, fuck that shit. It is what it is. It's a cartoon. I like how it is. I don't want that shit to be fucking subversive. Like, let that shit be dumb. Let this shit be dumb.
Yeah, I mean, and like I said, it's not for me. I can see for the people who it's for, it's really for them.
Yep. All right, so moving from that, let's get into last night in Soho. Me and you went to a screening of this where we got an Edgar Wright Q&A afterwards. This is very much an Edgar Wright film. It's not funny. Like, all of his previous films have, even Baby Driver, have humor to it. This is a through-and-through psychological horror movie.
Yeah, even like the parts that were supposed to be cute and sort of like humorous had like this, you had this impending sense of dread.
Yes, yes. That sense of dread runs throughout the film. As soon as she leaves the cottage and gets on the train, that's when you know shit's going to go sideways.
Right, right. And I mean, when we were talking to Edgar Wright, he said he wrote this 10 years ago, but honestly, it's very topical because he made a Me Too horror movie.
Yeah, man, I felt the same way coming out of this as I did with The Last Duel, which is, we ain't shit, man.
Oh, yeah. Men are fucking horrible.
My one problem with the movie is they laid on the character of Jocasta a little too thick. She's the bully. And I thought you could dial her down a notch or two, you know? Like, we get it.
You could have dialed
shit person.
Yeah, you could have dialed her down, but also I wanted some comeuppance.
Yeah.
You know, like you set this bitch up to be like the worst thing ever. And we honestly, if you see this movie, we all know people like Jocasta.
Yeah.
Yeah, like no matter what, it's always about them.
Bro, let me tell you a story real quick. On my way home Saturday from hanging out with my friends in Brooklyn, there's this bitch throwing gummies at my head while we're waiting for the A train at the subway.
A word?
Yeah.
Like, did you know her?
No.
Oh, that's a simple assault, man. You gotta stand your ground. You gotta punch that bitch in the face.
Oh, bro. And the one time she pelted it hard as fuck, and I looked over at her, and I saw her and her little friend giggling. And I was like, yo, y'all bitches look like you're fucking from a homeless shelter, first off. Second off, if it ain't me, somebody's gonna fuck you up. But you know, I wasn't trying to catch a case. I was just trying to get home.
I mean, yeah. I mean, fair enough. But like, was she young? How young was she?
Mid-20s.
See, that's that young 20s life. Like, I don't know what's wrong with the generation. I sound fucking old. I don't know what's wrong with the generation where they think it's all right to do shit like that in the real world and not catch hands.
Well, you know what made it worse? It was us. It was our people.
Oh, was it? Oh, they look like us. Oh.
And you could tell, you could tell exactly what part of New York they're from.
Look, we can't afford to be fucking up like that in public.
Bro, because the last chick who did this, remember, she got videotaped getting decked the fucked out. And then when they took that to the judge was like, yeah, that was self-defense. You threw hands first. So black women in New York, you think you're all cute and shit, fucking with people. You fuck around with the right one, you get prison time.
Well, here's the thing. When you said they look like us, I felt the same way when I find out there's a black serial killer.
Yo,
I'm like, ah, god damn it.
No, right? Fucking rare unicorn, the unfortunate unicorn. But speaking of us, I was so happy to see a black dude who's just written to be a good guy in Last Night in Soho.
Yeah, I mean, like, no ulterior motives. You know, honestly, I was scared for him more than I was scared for the main actress.
Oh, yeah.
You know what scene I'm talking about. I was like, man, this white woman is drunk. You're not supposed to be in her apartment. And she is screaming. You need to get the fuck out.
Well, it was that scene I was scared for him. And then at the end. And there was two ways that this could have went. And thankfully, Edgar took the opposite way both times. Where I was just like, thank Christ. Because, man, I would have been heated. I guess he knows better, though. Edgar knows better.
For what it is, it's a very progressive movie, you know? Like, when it comes to that, like, the black character speaking on, like, what women have to go through in the entertainment industry. Also, like, playing to the whole entire, like, women are also, you know, as much as, like, I'm not just saying women, but like, you know, black people, also, like, how we're supposed to be lifting each other up, but in some cases, we're more likely to fuck up our own, like, we're fuck up someone else who looks like us's game just to get ahead. It's that crab bucket.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I can't wait to see this again. Edgar Wright, I think every one of his movies, except for one, which we'll get into maybe another time, is rewatchable, you know, I don't want to discuss that right now.
All right, but we can tell him what it is.
The World's End.
Yeah, The World's End is horrible. Yeah, I it's out of the Cornetto trilogy?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, out of the Cornetto trilogy, it is the one that I like the least, and in Edgar Wright's whole entire, like, CV, I think it's his weakest one.
Yeah, it is his weakest film. Do I think it's horrible? No, but it's not a movie for me. Like, it's definitely just not for me.
No, I haven't seen it in years. Maybe age and distance will make that shit better to me. But right now, like, as of now, as I remember it, nah, dog.
Well,
that's a pass.
Let's say this on air. So this is going to be on air for both of us. Me and you, we're going to pick an episode. We'll talk about it. And we'll rewatch it and come back for you guys. A World's End revisit.
Maybe I've gotten older and I can appreciate it
more. Yeah. I have nothing else to say. I'm very interested to see what the people I'm going to see this with will think of it. Because honestly, after Dune, it could go 50-50. I don't even know anymore. Yeah, Last Night in Soho comes out Friday the 29th. And like, definitely see it in a theater. Like, it's sound. The sound design is amazing.
Right. And like, let's give it up for like class. Like, for this year, classic ghost stories have made a comeback and they're killing it. You know, The Night House killer, and like the last Leo Last Night in Soho, which is, you know, it's a ghost story.
Yeah, this is. I'm so glad this came out. They held this for spooky season because this is a perfect movie for spooky season. It's not your typical horror movie because it takes its time telling the story. It has a brain, thank God. So yeah, man. Go see this and. You know, let's move right into Dune, man. You start off.
Woo! Dune, baby. WB fucked up.
Yes. Because part two should have been locked and loaded. And had this had failed, this should have been, like, if part one had failed, this should have been an HBO Max exclusive and then do a week or two long run in IMAX to make some more money.
You see how big a mistake WB made with this movie, because this movie is so amazing. Like, watch it five times type amazing for all the little shit that you didn't get.
I saw this with some people and these people didn't like it. My brother in particular had some problems with it. One of his problems I would like to speak on, which is just, I think, a problem with most audiences in general nowadays, they forget how film language works. And let me tell you what I mean by that. You know the big spaceship that it looks like a worm in space, the big round white one?
Yeah, the I'm thinking that's sort of like their not time tunnel, but like their docking station. That's how they transverse the universe. That's what they use the spice
for. Yo, okay. Thank you. Because my brother's like, I don't get what that's for. I'm like, bro, Denny uses cinematic language. So when Timothy's watching the video about Arrakis, it cuts to it where he says spice is used for interstellar travel. And then whenever they cut to that ship, there's always other ships coming out of it. So they use that ship for long distance travel. And then the other ships are just short-range ships to go maybe planet to planet or off-world real quick. Like, that's not hard to understand.
I thought it was just sort of like a wormhole that they designed. Like, that you know, it transports, it creates a portal in time, whatever like that, or in space, for the other ships to come through. I didn't think it was a transport ship itself. But no matter what, I know that that's the thing that gets them to where they need to go.
Yo, okay, thank you, Christ. All right, thank you. Also, my brother had a problem with the politics of the movie, and I think the politics are all clearly spelled out, right? Because he's like, what's the purpose of the political purpose of the Bene Gesserit? The Bene Gesserit, for those of you who don't know, there are like space witches, basically, that use the Force. Paul's not supposed to exist. Like, they say Lady Jessica, she was supposed to have a girl and she chose to have a boy. And not only did she chose to have a boy, but she trained them. She trained Paul in the way of the Bene Gesserit, which is also a no-no. And now on top of that, because of a perfect storm, he actually might be the one. And the one is going to like save the universe and unite the universe and put the universe on the and put humanity on the path to righteousness. And that's what pissed off the Bene Gesserit, and that's their political motivations, is that they want Paul out the paint. Because when the Reverend Mother gives Paul the test, the Gomjobber test, you could clearly tell on her face that she secretly wants him to fail, because she's ready to kill this nigga.
Right, but here's my thing. they know that the one is gonna be male, right?
Was that made clear?
I mean, that's what, like, see, that's this movie in a nutshell. It's nebulous, but it's concrete in the same. Okay, I got that they're trying to test him so much because they don't want a false prophet. You know, they're not trying to sabotage him, but they're not trying to help him because, like, the true Messiah isn't going to need help.
Right. Shit's going to get more complicated in the sequel because in the movie, Paul straight up tells his mom, she's like, yo, I know you're pregnant and I know you're pregnant with a girl. So the fact that she's going to have a girl, that's not going to help him.
Right. But I think like he is the one. And I'm also saying this because I remember bits and pieces from the David Lynch fucking shit. And I think like some shit goes down. But I feel like the David Lynch movie is a fever dream. And so I don't know how much that compares to the actual book and how much it's going to like be in the sequel. So for all I know, David Lynch's Dune could have made up half the shit that was on screen.
Well, I'm not going to compare this adaptation.
Well, I'm not comparing them. I'm just like saying story-wise.
Right.
I think that's where the...
Well, the only reason why I'm saying I'm not going to do it is because I saw some people complaining on Twitter about how fast House Atreides made it from Caladan to Arrakis when they're like, in the book, it took them 4 chapters on their journey from Caladan to Arrakis.
Because it's a fucking book.
And it's a fucking movie, bro. Like, I understand probably would have worked better as a TV show because there's just so much here. But at the same time, that shit sucked in Game of Thrones too, where you'd spend 3 or 4 episodes watching these motherfuckers go place to place. Like, I don't want to see that again. I don't want to sit through that again.
So you can't please nerds. You can't. And as a nerd, I know. You know, like, I'm not a Dune nerd, but I'm a nerd in some other, you know, other fashions. You can't please them because they want what they want exactly how they want it, instead of being happy that they got what they got. This would have worked as a TV show, right? But would it have gotten a second season?
Well, real quick, before we jump back into the movie, let's talk about the movie's success. It was projected to open anywhere from 30 to 35 million. It opened at 40. This is the highest opening weekend that Warner Brothers has had because of this HBO Max deal. And they said it probably would have made maybe 60, 70 had it not premiered on HBO Max.
You mean it made more money than Space Jam 2?
Yeah. Get this, Jeff. This has one of the highest opening weekends for IMAX ever. Like 10 million of that 40 came from IMAX.
Because we have to say this. We'll say this over and over again. You need to see this loud, big and loud.
Yes, it's an experience. It's like, I imagine watching this is what I've imagined. Like, I had the feeling of like watching Fellowship of the Ring the first time, or watching Lawrence of Arabia for the first time, or watching Inception for the first time, where you're just like, you're seeing something meant for a mass appeal audience, but it's so smart and so dense and so complicated that it's almost like, wow, it feels like it's made just for me and nobody else.
That's a perfect encapsulation. Feels like it was made for the individual. It felt like it was mine.
Oh, Jeff, hold on. I'm going to update this. It is now, the official numbers are in. It's 41 million, not 40. This should leg out worldwide. Hopefully it'll leg out to 350, 400. But yeah, man, because 1 million, you know that IMAX we like to go to in Lincoln Center, where I went to this past weekend?
Yeah.
It made $1 million just at that theater alone over the weekend.
Right, because, you know, it was a perfect storm of people wanting to get out of the house, and also this movie giving them a reason to go.
Because I text you this Friday. While I was at work Friday, I had gotten texts from friends and people who know me, and I got messages all across social media saying, I started watching Dune. I got like 10 minutes in, 5 minutes in, 30 minutes in, and I turned it off and I bought a ticket and I'm going to go see it in a theater. Or I had people who were like, just saw it in IMAX, just saw it in a theater. Now I'm going to go home and watch it 2 more times on HBO Max and may even see it another time in theaters.
I saw it 3 times on HBO Max,
and I'm going to go see it in IMAX just because I need to see it big. I need to see it loud. I need to see it with a crowd of people all feeling the same emotions, you know, like that same sense of
work. Right. Yeah, man. So that, I mean, let's move on to what I want to ask you, Jeff, which is, after your first time watching this, were you ever confused? Because one of the things somebody said to me after this was like, they were like, it didn't make sense. I was confused and there was too much lore. And I will give them that. There is a lot of lore, but I was able to keep up with it my first time.
No, none of that was all of that confusing. It was all just, it was out there. You just had to pay attention.
Yes.
People are just so used to dumbed down sci-fi.
Yes.
Being force-fed and spoon-fed all of this shit. And anything you actually have to think about, you know, it becomes, you know, and no offense to them. I'm not calling anyone stupid, but like we're just so conditioned not to care, you know, like just spoon feed me everything I need to know. And even, you know, even if we talk about Game of Thrones earlier, even Game of Thrones was like that.
Yeah, I don't know how you watch Game of Thrones and get lost in the sauce in this, because I feel like this was a little more easier to digest than the first like four episodes of Game of Thrones. Especially because most of Game of Thrones is just people talking in castles.
Right. And like, honestly, there's only three parties. Well, I mean, four parties that you have to be concerned with in Dune. You have the Bene Gesserit, you got the Harkonnens, you have Atreides, and the Galactic Empire and the Fremen. All right, so five political parties, and like you never see the Emperor.
No, obviously he's gonna pop up in part two, because that's, to me, this is what Paul's arc is. And two, he's gonna take over the Emperor. Like he's gonna find out the Emperor tried to fuck him over, and he's gonna kill him.
Right, I mean, he already knows the Emperor, you know, fucked him over with that. Yeah, I didn't find anything confusing. What was kind of a misdirection is that we're led to believe that all of Paul's dreams are like facts. They're like the stuff that's going to happen, and you know, like I hate to make a sand reference, but all of his dreams, they're all fluid. They're like sand. They're moving. You know. Like this whole entire, all of his flashbacks with Jemez, you know, like him being a friend and like training him and everything like that, you know, that doesn't come to fruition.
I was thinking maybe that does happen. Maybe that is an
alternative timeline.
Maybe, you know, like, he's having visions of his ghost helping him out.
I mean, yeah, I mean, all of that could come in part two, or it could just be like one decision happened and now the future has shifted.
Right. Because we do see the visions of what is going to happen, which is like the battle, right? He has the vision of the battle. That's obviously going to happen. The vision of him and Chani back on his homeworld, obviously that's going to happen. But you're right. I think that might be fluid because he does have a vision of Chani killing him. And I don't think that's going to ever happen.
Right. But you also got to realize that like even the head truthsayer said that he's still untrained. Like he doesn't like his powers aren't, you know, 100%. So like, we don't know. Like maybe with more training, more exposure to the spice, he'll be able to control all of that much better. And his visions will actually be 100% true instead of like, you know, 75% average.
Well, now that we've gotten that out the way, because I'm glad you were able to digest this, because the first time I saw this, I was able to digest this, but I was just saying it's a lot. And on a repeat viewings, it does, everything's so much easier to digest. And the movie moves so fast on repeat viewings. It's amazing how fast it goes by.
Honestly, it was fast on the first viewing.
Okay.
You know, like for a movie that's supposed to be 2.5 hours, it felt like there was, because it's nonstop.
Well, somebody was like, it felt like three. And the only part I was interested in was when the sandworm ate the harvester. I was like, really?
That was the only part they were interested in, huh?
All right, so
you got to get a better caliber of friends.
So I want to talk about the characters, because a lot of people have been poo-pooing what the actors have been doing here. And I feel like the actors, every single actor in this movie is giving a great performance. Like, let's start with Timothée Chalamet as Paul, because I always, when people tell me like, oh, it was all right, I was like, no. The gom jobber scene. Like, my man's is acting in that gom jobber scene where he is going from fear to legit pain, where he starts crying. Like, you see the fear in his face. Then it turns to terror and pain where he's crying and screaming. And then when his mom starts reciting the fear is the mind killer speech, and he remembers that to help him overcome the test. And you see all that just wash over him, and he's just like, okay.
The dude went cross-eyed during that scene. Did you notice that at the end? Like, he was in so much pain, he went cross-eyed.
And that is acting, bro. Like,
yeah, no, like, it's like there was no weak link here. You know how I know there was no weak link? I even believe Jason Momoa could act.
Oh, no. To me, it was Dave Bautista. When they made Dave Bautista like this fucking savage force of nature, and he ain't even in the movie that much, where I'm just like, oh, I'm terrified of this motherfucker. Like, that's when I, because Jason Momoa, I always knew he could act. Duncan Idaho is definitely the best character in this, because he's just the fun-loving boy. But yeah, Paul is literally George Lucas stole Luke Skywalker from Paul Atreides.
I was talking to someone this weekend about that. Like, Dune is the OG. Lucas stole from Kurosawa films. He stole from Westerns. He stole from Valerian and Princess of Mars. And when did Dune come out?
1965.
Yeah, he stole from Dune.
Like, the only things that were around before Dune were Valerian and Princess of Mars. And, like, Dune basically is the one that people say, like, oh, yeah, we stole from Dune.
Yeah. I mean, it's one of those things where, also, you got to look at the audience. The audience, for the last 40 years, they've been watching Dune. They just didn't know they've been watching Dune.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
You know? So now they expect something different. They expect something next level. It's like, well, no, you're getting the OG. Like, you're getting the stuff right from the tap.
Yeah. And there's still the character work there to go with it. Like, I love speaking of Rebecca Ferguson throughout this movie, she looked right, bro. Like, right and tight. But
I mean, everyone was talking about, you know, Zendaya, right?
Like, beautiful girl. Beautiful
girl. But she was no Rebecca Ferguson.
Yeah, Rebecca Ferguson, she was right and tight throughout this movie, where I'm just like, damn. But yeah, even her, I love her, how conflicted she is the entire movie, where she has to be Paul's mother and protect him, but also be loyal to the Bene Gesserit.
Right. She's got a higher master. So, like, how do you reconcile that?
Right.
You know, how do you like, all right, yeah, I love my son, but also, like, with the head Bene Gesserit.
So, oh, the Reverend Mother?
Like, the Reverend Mother, when she was like, yeah, we play the long game. We count our successes in centuries.
Yes. The one thing, and that leads to two of my favorite scenes in the movie, and they both have to deal with, three of my favorite scenes. They deal with the family, which is when Paul, because, you know, he's a kid, man. Like, I hated Luke Skywalker in that first Star Wars movie because he's just a whiny little bitch. And this, I understand why Paul's a whiny little bitch, because he's a 15-year-old kid. Not only did he just found out he may be the one to save the universe, but then he's also a scion to a fucking house. And he's learning all these fucking superpowers from these space witches. Like, after, and he's being taught all these languages and taught how to fight and kill at will. Like, yeah, I'd be fucking tired too. I'd be like, yo, I want to go live my fucking life, man.
Because they don't, like, because they spend more time explaining why Paul is emo as opposed to why Luke Skywalker was emo. Like, Luke Skywalker was just emo because he didn't want to drink blue milk and work the farm. Like, Paul's got so much other stuff on his shoulders, you know? Like, it's like, I get it. And like, when I, on my first viewing, I'm not gonna lie, I did find Timothée Chalamet's performance to be a little too in his feelings. But on the second viewing, it's like, okay.
That's by design.
I get the subtlety. Yeah, I get the nuance.
This character has an arc. Like, he starts off this movie kind of just like he really doesn't know what he wants to be. And there's a million people pulling him in a million directions. And by the end of this movie, he fully accepts his destiny as possibly being the one and now being the new leader of House Atreides. Like, full stop.
Like, the old, like not even like the leader of House Atreides, the last Atreides.
Right. Like, right. That's why I hate when people say there's no character work. And I'm like, no, you're not paying attention. You have Sharon Duncan Brewster. This is my first time seeing her in anything. She's the black Fremen woman who's the counselor to the emperor. Like, even she's conflicted because she's like, fuck, I gotta watch these people fail and they're good people. Then I gotta be loyal to my heritage of the Fremen, but then I also have to pledge allegiance as an advisor to the emperor. And all that really came into play for me, her confliction in that last 30 minutes where she shows back up.
People complaining that there's no character work. The entire movie is character work.
Yeah.
Like, the battle scenes are epic and stuff like that. But if you look at it, there's only three fight scenes.
Yes.
There's only three battle scenes. And one of them is a flashback.
Well, maybe a vision, flash forward.
Or flash forward, whatever like that. So, like...
Yeah, because, I mean, fucking... Bro, I love that scene where he, Paul's like, bro, I don't think... He tells his dad, like, yo, I'm not the leader of House Atreides. And I love when his dad's just like, that's fine, because you're my son. And that's all I ever wanted you to be, is my son.
Like, I knew, like, when I was watching the trailer and that line came in, I was like, this movie's for me.
Yeah.
That sold it.
And I do love the two more scenes when they get to Arrakis where both of them involve Lady Jessica and the Duke Leto, where Leto tells Jessica, he's like, with so much regret in his voice, he's like, I should have married you. You know what I mean?
Right.
That was a really powerful moment for me. And my brother's like, why didn't he marry her? And I'm like, probably because he's the head of the house, and marrying a space witch isn't as valuable as maybe marrying the head of the Harkonnen house. Like, obviously, right. Everything's a political play in this movie.
And honestly, like, maybe one of our Dune fans can tell us this. I don't even know how the Bene Gesserit work. Like, I don't know how, like, if... Like, is there a Bene Gesserit in every royal house that goes to the Duke or the Baron and stuff like that to keep an eye on them? I don't know the inner workings of that.
Let me ask you this. Did you care?
No, not really.
Exactly. That's why I'm just like, bro, it frustrates me it frustrates me that certain little things bother people, but in other movies, like, shit like that gets a pass, because I'm just like, it's not that important. And if it is important, I guarantee you they're going to address it in part two.
It was like, but like, let's put it on the table. It was a touching scene.
Yeah.
And that's all it needed to be.
Just like the next touching scene I want to talk about, which is when the Duke clearly realizes, like, oh, this shit is a trap. Like, we were set up to be fucked. Like, the Emperor is going to fuck us. And he has to pull Jessica aside and say, yo, you're going to protect Paul? And she says, yeah, with my life. And he's like, no, I'm not talking to Paul's mom. I'm talking to Paul. I'm talking to Lady Jessica, the Bene Gesserit. I'm talking, is the Bene Gesserit going to protect our kid? And for that, she never gives a clear answer. But I think by the end of that movie, it becomes clear that, yes, even the Bene Gesserit Lady Jessica will protect Paul.
Right. I mean, you really do have to experience this movie. And like I said, you can't compare you can't compare David Lynch's version to this. And like, any kind of comparisons, like, two different animals, two different types, time frames, and just like two different sensibilities.
I started watching the David Lynch one and I got like 5 or 10 minutes in and I turned it off because the Emperor and his daughters were in it. And I was just like, I turned it off just because I'm like, these characters are nowhere to be found in this first part. And you know what?
Right.
I want to see how Denny's going to tell this story first and foremost. Like, every day I want to know, I'm so dying to know how this story plays out that I'm tempted to pick up the book. But then I'm like, you know what? I want to be just as thrilled as I was seeing this first part as I am going to go into part two. Because let's be real, part two is going to happen.
Right, part two is going to happen. But the thing is, I don't know if I can wait the 3 years it's going to take for this to go from script to screen.
Let's talk about that. Denny specifically said the reason why he didn't get to film part one and part two back to back was because Blade Runner 2049 underperformed worldwide, specifically in America.
Because smart sci-fi. I didn't like that movie. I can understand how other people did right. like it. It was, to me, it was a good film. It just didn't need to be made.
I think it's better than the first one. But that's a whole nother podcast.
Right.
My thing is here is this movie cost $165 million, which is if you're going to spend that much money, you might as well throw down the rest of the money to make part two, because now you when this movie ends, it's not even an ending. It just stops. And like I told you before, the only thing preventing me from making this a masterpiece is that the fucking movie just stops.
Right. There's no beginning, middle, and end to this first part. It's just beginning.
Yes.
And end.
Yes. And that's what I think pisses off one of the people I went with. What pisses them off is, like, he told me it was nothing but a first act. But to me, it does have the three-act structure, but it's missing an ending.
Right. And, you know, let's talk about, like, I'm going to keep on shitting on WB about this. Why you spent $165 million on a movie, right, that obviously needed a sequel. It obviously needed a continuation. Not just like, okay, it has a possibility for a sequel. Like, no, it's got a built-in sequel. So why are you going to spend that money at all if you didn't have faith in it?
Yeah, and here's my other thing too. Like, what's weird is you read the comments from Anne Sarnoff, and she's like, part two is going to get made no matter what. And I'm saying, and my thing to that is, then fuck, why didn't y'all just have it ready to go if part two was going to be made no matter what?
Right, and I sent this to you as a text when I said, putting all this money into part one and not even trying to get a part, do them concurrently, right? Or, you know, like, consecutively. It's like paying for a hand job, but paying for half of it.
Right. You don't get the climax. You know what I mean?
I don't get the climax. Like, I'm going to put it's like that. All right. So let me repeat that so Frank can cut this up, whatever, like that. So paying for the first half of Dune without even having a plan for the second is like paying for a hand job and not playing for the first half and not the second half. It's a waste of money.
Yes, because
you want the second half.
What did I say? I told you this too in a text. I was like, Dune Part 2 should be coming out next year. And then 2024, we should be getting Dune Messiah. Because from what I understand and what people have told me about Dune Messiah, I think that's the movie that people are really going to dig, because one of the questions a lot of people bring up is, why do these, because the Fremen are basically space Muslims. So they're like, why would these space Muslims help this little white boy take over the galaxy and rule the galaxy? And wouldn't that be a bad idea? And Dune Messiah explores that.
But, and here's also the thing. They don't care about the rest of the universe. They just want Arrakis for Arrakis.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And, you know, talking about, yeah, like, this is, you know, a parable for the Middle East. The Fremen are is Islamic culture. Spice is oil. These warring houses are every nation that has come to the Middle East to try to, you know, get the goods.
I told my brother this. I was like, it surprises me how many Republicans love this movie, considering it is about a little liberal white kid helping a bunch of brown people take back what's theirs from the rich white people who want to keep everything and exploit others.
Right. I mean, this is, you know, this is about colonization. Yes. This is about capitalism.
Extreme capitalism. And it's not, environmentalism. It's not like, because she even says, like, those spice harvesters fuck up the environment.
Right. So, like, but this is an indictment of all those things. It's not a, you know.
This book was written in 1965, and it's crazy to me how relevant it is to what's going on today.
Well, just like last night in Soho, we think, like I said, it was like the Me Too horror movie, but honestly, it takes place in the 60s. What goes around keeps going around. You know, we are horrible people who have yet to reach enlightenment or even try. Like, so if it happened yesterday, it's happening today, it's going to happen tomorrow.
Yes. Yeah, so I will say this. The one thing I do love about this half of a movie, everything that's set up in this is by the end of the movie paid off.
Well, like, yeah,
everything that's set up comes back into play and is paid off, right? So, like, Dr. Krennitz, when she puts the thumper down to potentially ride a sandworm, bitch, at the end of the movie, we see a dude riding a sandworm, and Paul, it clicks for, and I love how that clicks for Paul at the air, because at the beginning, his father says, like, the Duke of Leto says, we rule by air power and sea power. We need desert power. And when Paul sees that dude riding the worm, he's like, fuck, that's desert power.
It is a movie worth watching.
And you need to see it in IMAX. A good 80 minutes of this of the runtime's in IMAX. Like, it's made. There's a reason why Lincoln Square has been sold out and keeps selling out. I got tickets to see it again this weekend.
You need to see this movie just so WB knows how badly they messed up.
Yeah, yeah, because this day and date, like I said, the day and date HBO Max thing, like, if they didn't do that, this could have easily been like 60, 70 million opening weekend.
Right, right. And, like, I'm not into the box office stuff like that. Like, I mean, I care, but I don't care. I just want as many people to see this movie as possible, because just like Star Wars inspired me to be a filmmaker, Lord of the Rings inspired someone else to be a film, like the generation behind me to be a filmmaker, this is going to inspire the next generation of filmmakers that you can do like epic and smart.
I really hope, because another reason why they're letting Denny do part two is because they want to keep him on the lot because they lost Nolan. So they want him to be the new...
They want him to be Nolan.
And my thing is, if that's the case, when he goes to make the rest of these Dune movies, give him the money and stay the fuck out the way.
Right. And, like, if you want to talk about how he's the new Nolan, I think, look, I appreciate Nolan sometimes, right? But he's bought into his own hype. Denis seems like a painter whose canvas just happens to be celluloid.
He makes more difficult films, you know what I mean? But it is...
Right, he makes challenging films. Like, he makes challenging and emotional films. The one thing that that Nolan is missing is emotion. Right.
Because there's emotion in Blade Runner. There's emotion in Prisoners. There's emotion in Sicario, and the emotion is what fuels Arrival. Like, that's the whole purpose of Arrival.
Right.
This has been this is a base, like, a family story first and foremost, told on an epic scale. Like, politics aside, yeah, it's political and it has all that other shit in there. But first and foremost, for me, this is a story about a family and a family that's trying to arrive and find its place in this universe. And it's a family that's well known and well liked. That's why the Emperor is trying to fuck them over, because, like, he's like, oh, we can't have these niggas be more popular than me.
Yeah, like, you know, that's, what is it, the 51 rules of power? Never outshine the master.
Yeah, well, I mean, I can, and what's amazing to me is everybody who's read the book has said, like, part two, when it comes out, is going to blow part one out of the water. Like, even Denny, Denny has said, part one is just setting the table, and part two, I'm going to give you a feast, and it's just going to be nonstop, relentless action.
Yeah, and I can't wait for it. That's why I'm pissed off that I have to wait three to 4 years. Even if they run into production in February, we're still talking like a year to film under unknown circumstances, because we don't know how this pandemic thing is going to play out.
I think if they start filming in February, which is the rumor, I think we could get part two in 2023.
I mean, hopefully, you know, hopefully.
I asked my friends who read the book, I'm like, is it just one sandworm or is it more than one? And they're like, it's a whole planet. And he said,
yeah, I think like sandworms. That's what I got. Yeah,
from what I understand, the in the battle in the book, there's going to be multiple motherfuckers using those sandworms to really do some crazy ass shit.
I can't wait. Like, all of you nerds out there, all you Dune nerds, you don't like, you should be happy that you got this, and you got this as well as you did.
I would even go farther than Dune nerds. This is a movie for everybody, just because you don't get shit like this anymore. A movie that is patient in its storytelling, cares about the characters, isn't afraid to get deep and dense, and doesn't care if you keep up with it or not, and has a scale and scope that is this epic. Like Nolan has said this in an interview. He's like, Dune is the first movie where I can't tell what's real and what's VFX, because everything is blended together so perfectly. Because Denny has said there's only one green screen shot in the entire movie. So the rest is just a blend of realism and VFX.
It's old school filmmaking like we don't get anymore. I think we were complaining about in another episode that, you know, why so much CGI for characters and things that could have been practical effects? You know, because like the real stuff always looks more real. It's real. You can touch it. You can act to it. And I think, and like this is a perfect example. Like, I mean, you can sort of tell that it's something was created, but you can't tell how it was created.
One of my favorite film critics tweeted out there, like, I will never watch a behind the scenes documentary or video on Dune because I don't want to know how they created magic. For that, I say, I get it. Because some things, it's a magic trick that you don't want to know how it's done.
I don't care where the things I like come from. I just like the things that I like.
I mean, Jeff, even when he picks up the sand and you see the red spice in the sand, like, you could almost feel it and inhale it yourself. You know what I mean? Because when he starts hallucinating, you feel those hallucinations every time he takes a handful of the spice.
I mean, and for all we know, that could just be glitter. But I don't want to know.
Oh, yeah. Like, the way they got the red to radiate in the air the way they did. And the thing is, one last thing. The way they do exposition in this movie is so creative, because it's not people telling you or talking to you. It's like shown. It's like Paul's watching educational videos.
You are discovering this land as much as the characters are, you know, like you said, like his video books, you know,
or when they go out for the first time, like some of the stuff is like when it's happening to them, that's when you're finding out.
It was like, oh yeah, you don't want to do that because that's going to kill you.
Right.
It's a beautiful film. So take away the great acting, take away the story, it is just a beautiful film.
Greg Fraser did his fucking thing on this movie. I'm so amazed at the imagery that he created. I would never in a million years, if you had given me the script, I don't think in a million years I could make the movie that Denny and Greg Fraser have made here.
And like, my last thing is, before we head out, is let's give a shout out to Hans Zimmer for doing subtly epic.
Bro, can I just say for real quick, how epic, I've never seen a scene in a movie where people are packing up and leaving be fucking epic. Like, that music sounded like it was from a progressive rock album. Where they're, you know what I'm talking about, right?
Right, yeah. When they're leaving, whatever, Caladan. And let's also talk about the use of...
Yo, I want that for every time I walk in the room now, nigga. Like, I want a nigga walking in with bagpipes to introduce me. House Norwood, play the fucking bagpipes, nigga.
you heard that here first, Film Blurred Nation. I think I'm going to coin that now. We call it Film Blurred Nation.
This gets our pick of the week.
We need someone.
I'm giving everybody flowers. Definitely. Everybody gets fucking flowers for this.
Like, production design. Like, I don't know who you are. I mean, I will go and do a podcast myself where I just go through the credits and just clap and say your name. Because everybody,
the costume design, I want to say, for the Bene Gesserit, those costumes freak me the fuck out.
Yeah, I mean, it's hits on all levels. I can only, like, I'm giving applause to the craft services, you know, because craft services probably killed it too, you know.
So, Jeff, let me ask you.
Shout out to Transpo, they drove those cars like a month.
Let me ask you this, Jeff. What do you think part two is going to be? Because me and you, we have no idea what the fuck the book is. So I can only imagine what's going to happen in this second part.
I can pretty much guarantee that Paul is going to ride a sandworm and have a duel with it. Like, on us riding a sandworm. If he doesn't do that, then I'm going to hate the movie. He's got to have a fight on top of a sandworm.
All I know is this: the next part, I know, I feel it in my bones, it's probably going to be bigger than this first part.
Oh yeah, it's got no choice. It's set up for that. I apologize for the quality and of everything like that. I am on location right now with my team right here, and we're making awesome ish. But yeah, we had to get this down before the end of the week.
Please go see this in a theater. Please watch it on HBO Max. We need the franchise. The franchise must flow.
Franchise must, yo. Can we use that? Can we hashtag that? Yo,
and I'm gonna use this as a pull quote. I'm gonna use this as a pull quote across our social media. Dune Part One is a cross between Game of Thrones and Star Wars, filtered through Richard Wagner. That's our pull quote.
Bold words, but I agree.
We're the Film Blurreds. I'm Brandon Norwood, and I'm the motherfucking protagonist.
I'm the protagonist.
I'm Jeff Stewart, and I am not the motherfucking protagonist.
Don't come at us. It's just fucking movies.